from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Emotions don't just happen to you. According to Northeastern University psychologist Lisa Feldman Barrett, emotions are not hardwired but constructed in the moment. Coming up on Forum, we talk to Professor Barrett about her research and what it means to be the architect of our own feelings. That's the subject of her new book, How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain. And we want to hear from you. You can join us right after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Imagine that you're driving south on 101 and you see blue and red highway patrol lights flashing behind you. Do you feel worried? How about anxious, horrified, or scared? According to psychologist Lisa Feldman Barrett, emotions are not something that happen to people, but rather emotions are constructed in our brains, often with much more nuance than we readily acknowledge or realize. Professor Feldman Barrett joins us to talk about how emotions are made in this hour and the link between language and feelings and why assigning emotion to facial expression, for example, can have negative effects on everything from childcare to the justice system. We're also going to talk with her about a concept of something she calls superaging, and we welcome you to the program, Lisa Feldman Barrett.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Glad to have you. And let's sort of begin with what we're talking about here, your thesis, essentially. And it's come from a lot of study and research, but a bit of a heresy. It goes against the grain. Emotions aren't distinct. They're not located within some biological neural fingerprint or anything along those lines. Our brain constructs emotion. How do we know that this is the case?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons that why we know. First of all, scientists have been looking for the neurons in the brain that are dedicated to anger or sadness or fear for more than a century at this point and really haven't been able to find them. I think that's one way that we know. So, for example, scientists used to believe that neurons embedded in the amygdala were the home of fear, for example. And sometimes you will still read newspaper articles or watch television shows which talk about this small nucleus in your brain called the amygdala, which is the home of fear. But in fact, we know, for example, that people can experience fear and perceive fear without a fully formed amygdala. And when we actually peer inside the human brain as people are experiencing fear, what we see is a whole set of networks. You can think of them like kind of basic ingredients in a recipe. So sort of in the same way that flour and water and salt can be used to make many different types of foods and sometimes even non-foods like glue, for example. What we see when we look peer inside the brain is that these networks are interacting with each other, creating different recipes for one instance of fear versus another instance of fear. And exactly the same networks are used when you're angry, when you're happy, when you're thinking, when you're remembering, and so on and so forth.
This is going to upset a lot of people who saw that movie Inside Out. Probably already has.
Yes and no. I mean, I don't know. I love cartoons. And for example, I love Roadrunner cartoons, you know, where Wile E. Coyote doesn't fall. He runs off a cliff and doesn't fall until he looks down. Nobody would think that actually teaches us real physics. So it's perfectly reasonable to have a cartoon about emotion that, you know, doesn't really reflect the scientific understanding of how emotions work in the brain.
But you're saying there's no real brain region connected to a single emotion or region that would increase our emotions. And in fact, you know, we can have similar responses unemotionally, completely removed from emotions.
Absolutely. So we've done what in science is called a meta-analysis, which just means we find every published paper on a particular topic. So, for example, every brain imaging study that's been published where scientists have peered into the brain as people are experiencing, say, different varieties of anger or fear or sadness. And what we've done is statistically combine these results and find that there's no set of neurons anywhere in the brain, no region that is dedicated to any single emotion. In fact, any brain region that is implicated in one emotion is usually implicated in all of them, and as I said, in non-emotional events as well. So it used to be the case that scientists thought about the brain like a bunch of mental organs, you know, one region for thinking, one region for feeling, one region for seeing, and so on and so forth. But I think there's a growing appreciation in neuroscience that this is really not the way the brain is organized. It's not how it works.
Well, the other thing we learned from your research is that we don't have body patterns linked to emotion either.
Right. So again, scientists have been searching for the physical fingerprint for anger or sadness, you know, so is there a characteristic thing that your heart, you know, does your heart characteristically rise? Does your blood pressure characteristically rise? Do you sweat? Do you frown? Do you smile or so on? Particular patterns in different emotions. So, for example, the stereotype of anger is that you scowl, your cheeks get red, your blood pressure goes up, maybe you start to breathe more quickly. And what scientists have discovered is that people do lots of things in anger. People can, tremble in anger, jump in anger. They can scream in anger. They can hide in anger. They can attack in anger. They can even laugh in the face of anger. And bodies do lots of different things in anger. Similarly, people, you know, smile when they're sad. They cry when they're angry. They scream when they're happy. When it comes to emotion, variation is the norm. And this is every biological measure tells us that this is the case.
But when you write about, for example, links between anger and cancer, let's say, or links of airport security judging by facial or body movements, these become very important in many people's minds. And I'm thinking about a lot of research of a local psychologist whose work I'm sure you're familiar with, Paul Ekman, who talks about facial expressions and so forth. I mean, don't they really sometimes give us a clue to how somebody's feeling or to maybe be able to detect what they're trying to conceal and so forth?
Well, I never said that facial movements don't give a clue to how somebody is feeling. What our data and other people's studies show is that there is not one universal expression for, say, anger. Most of the time, people don't scowl in anger. In fact, you know, think about it. When's the last time you saw anyone win an Academy Award for scowling in anger? If you think about even what you see on television, as far as I know, I can only think of one major media person who's, you know, on television a lot who scowls when he's angry. For most of people, they do lots of different things with their faces when they're angry. And what we do as perceivers is our brains are using our past experience to automatically guess what a facial movement means in terms of emotion. So, for example, my husband makes a classic stereotypic scowl, like of the anger stereotype in our culture, when he's concentrating really hard. And he's not angry. It's not that he's misperceiving himself. He really isn't angry. He's usually concentrating or trying to figure something out. So what we know about the research is that when there is a particular kind of experimental method that when you use it can make it look as if everybody scowls in anger and can recognize scowling as anger. But when you use more methods that are more ecologically valid, meaning they mirror what people do in everyday life a little bit better, what we find is that people don't make a single expression in anger. And in fact, what perceivers are doing is they're making educated guesses automatically in the blink of an eye about what facial movements mean. And understanding that you're guessing really changes how you approach reading emotion in other people.
We're talking with Lisa Feldman-Barrett, and she's the author of How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain. So what we're saying is that a whole range of things, anxiety, stress, even maybe chronic pain, all constructed emotions.
Absolutely. So, for example, pain is a really interesting example. Scientists who study pain actually have defined it as an emotion. in the sense that in pain, what you're doing is what you do every other waking moment of your life. There are sensations and your brain is attempting to make sense of those sensations. Where did those sensations come from? And so it's not just sensations from your body that you do this with. You do this actually with sights and sounds and smells and so on. Your brain is constantly guessing. It's using your past experience to guess what the meaning of the sensations are. So with a particular flash of light, is it an object? Is it a, you know, is it a ball? Is it a car? Is it a bat? With smells, chemicals. Is it this smell? Is it that smell? And with an ache in your body, you know, an ache in your stomach, for example, can be disgust. It can be longing for someone that you miss. It can be anger. It can also be hunger. It can be nausea. It can even be simple fatigue. Your brain is constantly guessing. And, you know, most of the time, using your past experience, it guesses pretty well. But sometimes, you know, there are glaring problems, glaring errors. And in those moments, the fact that we're guessing, the fact that brains are guessing really reveals itself.
But we are not hardwired. We're not generated by any of these distinct regions, as you say.
Yeah, so hardwired is a tricky word, I think, because normally what people use that word to mean is a region of the brain that is innately dedicated to something like anger or fear or remembering or something like that. But that's not really what scientists think the word hardwired means. So when we use that word, we usually think about it as, is the brain wired to make this experience or to make this action? So, you know, an infant brain, for example, is not born. A newborn brain doesn't look like a miniature adult brain. It's missing a lot of the wiring that adult brains have. And so you can think about an infant brain as a brain that is awaiting a set of wiring instructions. You know, one of our evolutionary advantages is we have the kind of brain that wires itself to our physical and social surroundings that we grow up in. So brains, anytime you learn something, your brain is rewiring itself to be able to reproduce that experience or that behavior again. So emotions are, the wiring is there, but it's not dedicated to a single region or a single network or even a single pattern across the brain. Everything that we know tells us that emotions, variation is the norm.
Which is why you say we're shaped by previous experiences, but also a kind of number of different brain regions maybe interacting or operating spontaneously in accordance with one another. There are, in other words, and I think this is to the point, too, as you write, varieties of all of these emotions. And so once again, and this is something you say in your book, variation is the norm.
Absolutely. And you can use that to your advantage. So first of all, you can use to your advantage that variation is the norm in that you can try to cultivate new experiences of emotion. So if it's the case that, you know, your brain is using past experience to construct your experiences in the present, then anything new that you construct in the present, that you give effort to constructing in the present, will seed your brain to construct those experiences more effortlessly in the future, right? So if you cultivate additional experience, new experiences of gratitude or of awe or of happiness or even of anger, experiences where what your body feels like is different, but also what you do is different, then you are basically seeding your brain to have more control, more choice the next time you're in a similar situation.
And excuse me, that includes your senses presumably as well, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. So if we, you know, to us, it seems as if we just react to things in the world, right? So there's a microphone in front of you, so you see it, you know, there's sounds and so you hear them. And so to us, it feels as if we react to things in the world. Otherwise, our brain would just be dormant. But if you look at the wiring of the brain, you can see really clearly that that is not how brains are structured. And also, it's not metabolically efficient to have a brain that works like that. It's actually really expensive to have a brain like that. You know, brains are expensive organs anyways, so metabolic efficiency is really important. It's important to be frugal in how you spend your energy. So brains are organized in a way that allows you to predict. So really what's happening, every smell, every sight, every sound, everything you experience, including emotion, your brain is using in the present moment, it's making a prediction using past experience about what sensations are going to happen next. And then it uses the input from the world and from your body to either confirm those predictions and they become your experience, or to change those predictions, in which case that becomes your experience.
We're talking with Lisa Feldman Barrett, and her book is How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain. Daniel Gilbert, Harvard professor of psychology, says a brilliant and original book by the deepest thinker about this topic since Darwin. Boy, that's about as high praise as you can get. Emotions aren't universal, Lisa Feldman Barrett. Does that mean that, well, let me put this a different way. They are also, one would follow logically, different in different cultures?
Yes. So sometimes an emotion category like, let's say, sadness can mean something very different in one culture versus another. And then there are also differences in emotions that some cultures have and other cultures don't. So, for example, there is an emotion, gezellig, I can't do it with the ch, because it's a Dutch word, which means to feel coziness and comfort with those who you love. And so it's not that we can't make that emotion, even though we don't have the word, but we have to do what our brains have to take experiences from the past and combine them in new ways to make that experience. This is what cognitive scientists call conceptual combination. So you can take experiences from the past, make something new that you've never experienced before, out of the, you know, basic ingredients that you have available to you. So you and I can make gezellig, we can make that feeling, even though we don't have a word for it. But look at how long it's taken me to describe this word to you, to describe this feeling to you. It's really kind of inefficient. Whereas if you knew the word, well, Michael, now you know the word, so the next time I say the word gezellig, a whole bunch of features.
I thought that was a character in a Woody Allen movie, gezellig.
If it wasn't, it should have been.
Well, let me go back with you a little bit to because your thoughts are on this and your research is fairly revolutionary. I'm using that word not even advisedly. I think it is revolutionary because you go back to somebody like Paul McLean, who said there were three layers of the brain. That was a brain model from the 1940s. You're kind of toppling that, but you're also toppling the notion. Well, there's a long-held notion, for example, that the limbic system once was mainly emotional, and now we have a whole different view of the brain, dimensionally.
Yeah, absolutely. So actually, the structural ideas about the brain go all the way back to Plato. So, you know, Plato had this idea that the human psyche, the human mind, had three parts: appetites, like hunger and sex, and emotions, or what he called passions. And he depicted those as two wild stallions, which were controlled by a charioteer, a human, which he thought embodied the notion of rationality. And what neuroscientists originally did when they were studying the structure of the brain was they took that Platonic view of the brain and they kind of tattooed it onto the human brain. So the idea was that you have a lizard brain where circuits for survival lurk, for hunger and sex and so on. So these are, you know, Plato's appetites. And then wrapped around this was a limbic system, an ancient limbic system where your inner beast lives, your emotions live.
I know it well, but telling me it's not necessarily
that's
there.
So, and then wrapped around that was, you know, your prodigious, very evolved cortex where rationality lived, which marks us as very different from all the other animals in the animal kingdom. The problem with this idea of brain structure, even though it's very popular and very compelling, it's a very compelling theory of human nature embodied in this idea, is that it doesn't actually fit the data. Scientists have known, evolutionary biologists have known for almost a century that the brain is not structured this way. And in fact, brains don't evolve like this. They evolve more like companies. You know, as companies grow, in size, they reorganize themselves to get efficient. And that's also true of the human brain, of actually of all brains. And so you do not have a lizard brain or an inner beast where, you know, your emotions lurk that are controlled by cognition. Your mind is not a battleground between rationality and emotion. It's, even though it feels that way to us, our experiences are not a super good guide to how the brain is structured or how it works, just in the same way that, you know, our experiences of the sun rising and moving across the horizon and setting don't necessarily make for a good theory of the solar system.
Well, if you had the belief that we can distinguish emotion and thought, or emotions are things in our brain, you may have to abandon it. Or for that matter, you may have to latch on to the idea that chronic pain and anxiety and stress and all those kinds of things are caused by constructed emotions, your brain constructing. That's a lot in the new book by Lisa Feldman Barrett, who is with us this hour. She's distinguished professor of psychology at Northeastern, and her book is called How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain. She's also with neuroscience appointments in psychiatry and radiology at Mass General Hospital and Harvard Medical School. And we invite you to join the program. I am going to talk with her about superaging, too, because that's a whole different notion, but it's tied to her research. But let's hear from you about emotions and how you think they're made and constructed, and you may want to react to what you've heard thus far. You may have questions, so indeed, you can be part of this program, and we invite you now. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. Please feel free to call us and let us know what your thoughts are or any questions you might have. Again, the toll-free number, 866-733-6786. A number of other ways you can join this conversation and be part of the program. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, or go to our Facebook page. A number of ways to be part of the program. And again, we invite you. Lisa Feldman Barrett with us. Emotions are a construct of the brain, she is saying, essentially. And also, we're going to talk a bit about superaging, as I promised. This is this has to do with the fact that maybe if you're over 65, pretty much have the neuron, I don't want to use the word neurons here. Let's say if you have the memories of a 25-year-old, you're in much better shape to have your brain functioning in a highest caliber way. Now, how do you get to that position is something that our guest has some position on, too, and has some thoughts on, and that comes out of her research. But we're going to go to your calls when we return and your emails. And again, feel free to join us by phone or by email or by going to our website, kqed.org/forum. In fact, a couple of comments before we go to break here. John writes, it's great to see science catching up to and confirming the construction of emotions supported in work done in contemplation or Zen. One can personally discover this by remaining in the moment and observing the nature of their own emotions as they arise. We'll hear from more of you when we return. Stay tuned. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Lisa Feldman Barrett, distinguished professor of psychology at Northeastern University and author of a book called How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain. And I said before we went to the break that we would go to your calls and emails, and we will forthwith. But I also said that I would talk with Professor Barrett briefly about superaging. This is a concept that has to do, as I said, if you're over 65 and you have the memories of a 25-year-old, you're in pretty great shape. And in your book, Professor Barrett, you talk about the Marines. Pain is weakness leaving the body. So the idea here is to get kind of thicker regions of the cortex by maybe experiencing some pain and gain in the process?
A little bit, yeah. We were doing research on the way in which feelings influence memory, because we know that there are not dedicated parts of the brain for memory and other dedicated parts of the brain for feeling. So in some of our earlier research, it seemed evident that as people age, they rely more on their feelings to as a guide for what to pay attention to and what to remember. And so we were running these experiments, and what we noticed was we in our elderly sample of participants, so these are people over the age of 65, about half of them had memories that on standard tests, on formal standard tests, they were scoring not just above average for their own age group, but they were indistinguishable in their memory from the average young person, so like the average 25-year-old. And we found this to be incredibly remarkable and exciting because we're really interested in trying to understand what the contributions are to successful aging. And so we were doing brain imaging studies, and so we were able to look at the brains of superagers. That's what I actually did not coin that term. That term was coined by a neurologist, Marcel Mesulam, at Northwestern University. But so we took our superagers and we looked at their brains and compared them to people above the age of 65 who were, you know, had a typical or slightly above average memory for their own age. And we noticed a whole suite of brain regions that were not just thicker, but also better connected in the superagers when compared to the typical elderly participant. And then when we compared the superagers' brains to young people in these regions, we noticed no differences, so that not only did they have youthful memory, they also had youthful brains. And these regions were the regions that were predicting memory performance on the tests that we gave. Now, what's cool about this, what's really cool, is, Michael, you mentioned the limbic system. Well, you know, there is no actual limbic system in the brain, but scientists use the word limbic to refer to a group of regions that are structured, where the neurons are structured in a particular way and where they project to the other parts of the subcortical parts of your brain that control the systems in your body. So your vascular system, your cardiac system, so it controls heart rate, and your respiratory system controls breathing, controls your stomach and your GI system, your immune system, your metabolism, and so on. These brain regions were the regions that were part of the this suite of regions which are thicker and better connected in superagers. And this makes a link between how well your brain is controlling the systems of your body and how good your memory is. These regions are also important for representing and creating the simple feelings of pleasantness and unpleasantness, and feelings of feeling worked up and feeling calm that come from your body. So we have the kind of brains that aren't really wired to experience sensations from our body in high definition the way we experience sights and sounds. Instead, experience the sensations from our body kind of as feeling pleasant or feeling unpleasant, feeling discomfort or distress, feeling kind of worked up and anxious or kind of calm. And so what's really interesting is that these brain regions are really active when in many different events, but really also when you're feeling unpleasant. So what we think is going on is that superagers have really good memories because when they start to feel uncomfortable in doing a hard task, instead of with stopping, so think about it like when you're exercising, for example, you know, when you start to, after about 20 minutes, you start to feel really unpleasant and there's a really strong urge to stop. Or if you're, you know, if you're me, it's after 5 minutes, there's a really strong urge to stop. Instead, superagers seem to take this as a cue, this feeling of yuckiness. They take it as a cue to work harder. And so pushing through the yuck, you know, no pain, no gain, you know, pain is weakness leaving the body. Well, pain may also be, or discomfort may also be a sign of weakness leaving the brain. So if you work hard at something and push through the yuck, the likelihood is that that will be very healthy for your memory.
And healthy for the memory because you get thicker regions of the cortex. And it really says volumes about the whole idea with the brain. If you don't use it, you'll lose it.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly right. I will just say one other thing, that these regions are not just thicker, they're also better connected, and they are they are at the core of the brain. Scientists think about these regions as the neural backbone of the brain. They help different networks in the brain communicate better, more efficiently with each other.
Yeah, I do want to bring our callers in, but I just want to say, because you mentioned brain imaging, these brain imaging studies that you did also divide the brain into kind of tiny cubes, 3D pixels, as I understand it. So there's no brain region that's connected to a single emotion. It's all kind of regional. Like I said earlier, it has to do with construction, according to what Professor Barrett has pointed out here in her book, Construction That the Brain Goes Through. Let me go through some of your calls, and let's get first Jennifer on the air here. Jennifer, morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So my three-year-old son very oftenly combines different emotions to express how he's feeling. And it reminds me a lot of your research and how, you know, as adults, we see things so black and white, you know, scared, happy, good, bad. And an example of it is that he will refer to things that make him feel scared as either happy scared or bad scared. And I'm wondering if this is a reflection of what your research is showing.
Absolutely. So I think that I'm not sure if your son is going to become a mathematician or a neuroscientist here. But the reason why I say that is, first of all, you know, fear is not always unpleasant. It's sometimes very pleasant. So, for example, think about a roller coaster, right? Think about being surprised or startled or scared in a movie, for example. And so when your son is combining happy and scared, he's really telling you there are some feelings of scared that are really pleasant and some that are really unpleasant. This is also true for anger. It's true for happiness. It's true for every emotion we've ever studied. And the reason why I say he might be a mathematician is that computationally, how we measure the complexity of emotion is often by having people rate their experiences using words. And they can tell you, well, this experience is about a 2 on happiness and about a 4 on anger and about an 8 on scared. Or this experience is about an 8 on scared and about an 8 on happy and about a 4 on anger, and so on and so forth. So it's possible that, you know, as I said before, brains, even little brains, can do conceptual combination. They can use bits and pieces of past experience in novel ways to create new experiences that have never been experienced before. That's really what your son is doing.
And Jenny, we thank you for that call. Get to as many of your calls as we can here. Let's go next to Phil. Phil, you're on. Morning.
Hi, good morning. So my background is in AI, and people in AI have been looking at emotions because they're a means of regulating activity. Somebody that's maybe scared might do different kinds of activities than somebody who's feeling bold. But the thing is I think maybe on the show you're a little overstating that there are parts of the brain that are dedicated towards measuring emotions. If you were to do a functional, you know, a PET scan, the, you know, emotions are everywhere because they're regulating all parts of the brain, but there are centers of emotions. So, for example, depression, we have drugs that can treat depression. Or people with Asperger's syndrome, you know, they have a hard time maybe forming emotions. There is a plasticity of emotions. So people with PTSD get in this terribly violent environment and their emotions get out of whack. Jill Bolt Taylor talks about this in her Stroke of Insight. So, you know, can you distinguish, you know, be clear that there are parts of the brain that are responsible for measuring and transmitting emotional states, that it's not just spread throughout the brain?
So, Phil, I guess what I would say to you is that I'm not saying that every neuron does everything. That's really not true. And I'm also not saying it's just the brain is some amorphous mass. But there really are no centers for emotion. There are systems in the brain that are very active during emotion. So if you think about the brain's intrinsic networks, well, let me back up and sort of say it like this. The brain is not a collection of regions. It's billions of neurons that are networked together. And this network is bathed in a chemical system, which changes the ease with which neurons pass information back and forth. So that's what allows one structure, your brain, to take on trillions of patterns. Now, those patterns can be understood as networks which are interacting with each other. And my point is that those networks that are interacting with each other in fear, for example, don't create one pattern for fear. There are different patterns for fear depending on what your brain is preparing you to do in fear in a given situation. That means that there is no dedicated center for emotion. The examples that you gave about depression, for example, or PTSD, there are many, many, many papers showing that the regions of the brain that seem to be very important for treating depression and treating PTSD are all, even the neurochemicals that are important, are domain general, meaning they are not specific to emotion. And in fact, if you look at a brain that has suffered depression from a person who suffered depression for a very long time, or suffered from PTSD, or suffered from diabetes, or any one of about 25 different diseases, and you look at the atrophy in the brain of the regions that are most responsible, people think, for these diseases, they are common. They are common regions. So I'm not saying the brain is doing nothing. I'm saying that that the brain is making patterns. Patterns emerge out of these billions of neurons that we have, and that an emotion, just like every other mental state you have, is a whole brain phenomenon. That really is what study after study after study seems to show, even in studies of psychopathology.
Since Phil brought up Asperger, I'm looking at a question here from a listener named Paul that I'd like to go to with you, Professor Barrett. Paul says, I've seen charts of caricatures of facial expressions used to help those on the autism spectrum interpret emotional states. How might this relate to your ideas?
Yeah, so it's interesting. Paul's question is one of the reasons why I wrote this book, actually. There are studies which have people, usually children or adolescents, on the autism spectrum, and they teach children that a scowl is, to recognize a scowl as anger and to recognize a smile as happiness, to recognize a pout as sadness, and so on. And kids, high-functioning kids on the autism spectrum, can learn these faces. But their ability to learn these faces does not translate into improved social and emotional functioning in everyday life. So there's no benefit. There's no transfer of benefit to the real world. And the reason why is that people rarely scowl in anger, and they rarely pout in sadness, and they smile sometimes in happiness, but they also smile sometimes in anger and at other times as well. And so there's tremendous variability that's driven by the context in which people are in that this training method is not teaching. And I thought to myself, if I were one of these parents and I was dealing with the difficulties, the real tragic difficulties of having a child who was struggling with autism, and somebody offered me a potential cure to improve their social functioning and their ability to emotionally relate to others, and I would be delighted, right? I'd have a ton of hope. And then I would watch my kids struggle to learn the emotional meaning of these faces and be really proud and hopeful. And then my hope would be dashed as I watched how this learning didn't translate into any benefit in the real world. And then I thought about what I would feel like if I had learned that scientists have known all along that this kind of training, the training someone on stereotypes, is not really going to prepare them for better social and emotional functioning in the real world. I don't have to tell you how I felt. Maybe you could imagine how you would feel if it was your kid. So I think, autism, what's interesting about a brain or brains of individuals who are on the autism spectrum is that unlike a neurotypical brain, which uses past experience in a way to predict the upcoming present, right? So it can take past experience and combine it in new ways to make predictions about what's about to happen So, for example, you know, to you, it seems like you're just listening to my words as I speak them and reacting to things I say. But in fact, your years of experience with English allows you to predict every single word that comes out of my mouth. But brains of people who are on the autism spectrum, don't have predictive structure to their brains aren't structured to predict very well. So they actually do have reactive brains. And as a consequence, they have very high levels of anxiety because they are unable to make sense of a lot of the sensory information in their world because it's so highly variable and their brains don't predict well and they don't combine information they don't combine past experience in novel ways. So in fact, you know, an autistic brain is, I mean, there are many varieties of non-neurotypical brains, but they tend to be brains that actually are reactive, whereas a neurotypical brain is more predictive.
We've got lots of calls, lots of emails. Let me get to as many of them as we can, and let's go next to Marjorie. Marjorie, you're on the air.
Hello. I'm interested in the origin of our inclination to do good. Some years ago, I read Antonio Damasio's book, Looking for Spinoza, Joy, Sorrow, and the Feeling Brain. And he seemed to suggest that there was a region in the brain that lit up, in quotes, when we were thinking about helping others. He seemed to suggest that this originated in the days when we lived in villages and the survival of the tribe required us to do what was in the best interests of the tribe, not just the individual or the family.
You know, Marjorie, you raise a fascinating question that I've always, it's maybe a metaphysical question, but I'd like to know what Professor Barrett has to say about it. Not only maybe something toward altruism in the brain, or is there something toward the opposite of the brain that is what we call maliciousness? Or, you know, I'm looking at a listener here who says, do emotions temporarily close our mind? What are the implications for law enforcement, racism, bigotry, things of that sort?
Well, we could talk all day about these, you know, these questions, your listeners' questions, Marjorie's fantastic question. And I do go into some of these issues in great detail. So let me just deal with Marjorie's question right off the bat. You know, I've read every book that Antonio Damasio has written, and I love his work. I don't agree with everything in his work, but I do agree with a lot of it. And one of the things that he's highlighted that I think is really important is that we are a social species. You know, what that means is that we regulate each other's nervous systems, and we do it without even thinking about it. So we use sights and sounds and smells and touches and so on to regulate each other. So, for example, there are other species that are social. There are some insects that are social, and they regulate each other's nervous systems, each other's bodies, with chemicals, with smells, right? Rats do it also with not just with chemicals, but also with sounds and some with touch. And with primates, they add vision, and we are primates. We also add words. So, Michael, as I'm talking to you, or if Marjorie's listening to me right now, the sound of my voice and the words that I say are actually having an effect on your heart rate and on your breathing. And Michael, if you and I were in the same room with each other while we were talking, we would, if we like each other and we trust each other and we're kind of having a good time, then our heart rates would probably synchronize, our breathing would synchronize, we might even start making the same movements. This is well documented in many, many, many experiments, many studies.
And let me mention that we did have Anthony Damasio on a while back. I think that interview is in our archives. I'd like to give listeners that heads up. And indeed, he is fascinating to read as well as to listen to. And I want to get more of your calls on here. But first, some listener comments or questions, really, maybe a little pushback. A listener says, what isn't a construct of the brain? For example, light can have a wavelength of 505 nanometers, but it is not green without a conscious human acquainted with the notion of that color.
Yeah, your listener is right. Exactly. Emotions are made in the brain exactly in the way that sights and sounds and exactly the way that the brain takes wavelengths of light and creates color experiences of color, exactly the way that the brain takes changes in air pressure and creates sounds out of them. That's exactly the way that the brain creates emotions. And I discussed that actually in one of the chapters in my book.
Heather wants to know, are emotions culturally bound? Can there be a collective unconscious, sounds like Jung, to a group's emotional framework and responses?
Well, if you think about a brain, a young brain as wiring itself, it's bootstrapping into itself the concepts and experiences that are important in a particular culture. So a brain wires itself to its social and its physical surroundings. Then what this means is that that an individual brain is wiring itself to function properly in a particular culture. It's becoming wired with the knowledge that is necessary to adapt and function well in that particular culture.
This may be a vital question for many of our listeners. Pamela writes that she's the mother of a tween and have relied on the understanding, which your guest is now debunking, that the teen prefrontal cortex is underdeveloped, and this explains their risky or otherwise irrational behaviors. If the regional concept of the brain is a misunderstanding, how would you explain what's going on in the teen brain?
Oh, well, I don't think that I'm disputing the idea that the brain is continuing to change its wiring as a person grows. So it's very well known that prefrontal cortex, that large swaths of the frontal cortex are continuing to change their wiring as teenagers grow. But the idea that the prefrontal cortex is the home of cognition that dampens down or controls our inner beast is a mistake. And in fact, there are a number of regions in prefrontal cortex that actually directly project to the systems that control, that upregulate, not just downregulate, but also upregulate the systems of your body. So they're not there to dampen. They're more like a dial. The cortex is more like a volume dial in a sense. It can upregulate or downregulate the systems of your body, and that's part of its function. But it also, prefrontal cortex is involved in creating emotions, not just in dampening them down. That's very clear from the scientific evidence.
Our guest is Lisa Feldman Barrett, and her book is How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain. And here's Guy. Guy, join us. You're on the air.
Thank you. I've suffered from chronic pain for many years, and there seems to be a higher level of pain than the physical symptoms the doctors have been able to detect through MRI, X-ray, so on and so forth. So my question to my Northeastern rival since I graduated from BU is, what in your study is relevant to something like that? And is there any potential for healing chronic pain that seems to not have corresponding physical factors that would explain either its severity or its longevity through your study?
Yes, absolutely. This is something I discuss in one of the chapters in my book. So the way to think about chronic pain is, remember how I said that the brain is structured to be predictive. So it's making a prediction about what sensations are going to arrive from the body and from the world as well, but definitely from the body. And then when the sensations arise, those either confirm its prediction and they become your experience, or it corrects its prediction. But sometimes the brain, when it mispredicts, doesn't correct its prediction. It just sticks with its own prediction. Now, there are a lot of reasons why that can happen, but when it happens, you experience something where there is no physical cause in the body. And so, for example, I think chronic pain is a little bit like phantom limb pain. It's your brain is expecting sensory input from the body that we call nociception, which is the sensations that come from tissue damage or impending tissue damage. It's expecting those, and in fact, those inputs never arise, but the brain, for one reason or other, doesn't correct itself. And so you experience pain, real pain, in the absence of tissue damage. And those prefrontal cortex regions we were talking about they actually are partly responsible for issuing those predictions and also correcting those predictions. And so they can act like a volume dial to not only cause your brain to predict pain, predict nociception, for you to experience pain even in the absence of tissue damage, but they can also serve to sort of turn up the dial on the how unpleasant that predicted pain will feel.
Lisa Feldman-Barrett, we've got seconds left here, and I just want to sort of attach something to Guy's question, because Paula wants to know, and I think a lot of listeners would want to know, how this information can help reform their emotions, particularly anxiety.
Well, I think it's one thing that the book makes very clear is that even though it's very hard for you to control your emotions in the moment, it's very hard to sort of snap your fingers and change how you feel, that doesn't mean that emotions are inevitable. There are many things that you can do to have much more control over your emotional life. The horizon of your control is much broader than you might imagine it to be. Mm-hmm. The book goes into explaining how this is the case.
They may just have to get the book, because we are flat out of time here. But the book, again, is called How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain. Lisa Feldman-Barrett, thank you so much for being with us this hour. I appreciate it and grateful to you. And Forum is produced by Irene Gucci, Tina Larberg, Susan Britton, Jeremy Siegel, and Judy Campbell. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. And we get online support from Amanda Font. Interns are Devin Holt and Stephanie Roberts. Our executive producer is Holly Kernan. Thank you for listening, and for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.